And I want you to take your Bible and turn to Psalm 84. And I want you to look with me at this Psalm numbered 84. I will read it in its entirety, but there is one verse in it that is the key to the chapter. But after I have identified that verse, I want you to keep your Bible open because I'll show you some other things in it that will help you to understand the key verse. And we'll spend just a little while with this now tonight. How amiable are thy tabernacles, O Lord of hosts. My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. Yea, the sparrow hath found an house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young, even thine altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. Blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will be still praising thee. Selah. That little Selah word, I think, is a musical interlude of some kind. Seen various explanations for it, but my friend Lonnie Moore, that many of you know, pastor down here in Nicholasville, Kentucky, and Lonnie's honestly, he's a great preacher, but he's one of the finest singers in all the land. He has a little song that he sings entitled, Well, Think of That. And he said to me the other day, he said, I think that Selah word may be put there just to get us to say, well, think of that. There may be other explanations, but I happen to like that one. The verse says, number 5, blessed is the man whose strength is in thee, in whose heart are the ways of them, who passing through the valley of Baca, make it a well. The rain also filleth the pools. They go from strength to strength, every one of them. In Zion appeareth before God. O Lord God of hosts, hear my prayer. Give ear, O God of Jacob. Behold, O God, our shield, and look upon the face of thine anointed. For a day in thy courts is better than a thousand. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man that trusteth in thee. Now the key verse is number 10. That says, for a day in thy courts is better than a thousand. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. Now if you keep your Bible open, it'll be helpful. Quite a good number of years ago now, when Betty and I were at high school graduation point, we had gone to high school together. In fact, we were sweethearts in high school, and we had gone to high school 3 of the 4 years at a little tiny high school down here, right where the Ohio and the Mississippi River bleed together, out from Paducah a little ways, on the edge of Graves County. A little high school in Lowes, Kentucky. L-O-W-E-S, Lowes, Kentucky. We graduated together, and there was, at that time, about 150 kids in that high school, 48, I think, in our graduating class. And prior to our graduating, in fact, something like a half century before our graduating there, another gentleman graduated from that high school that long since has been recognized as one of Kentucky's favorite sons. And I'm talking specifically about a gentleman from the western tip of the state named Alvin W. Barkley. Alvin Barkley, as a young man, graduated from Lowes High School, ran for McCracken County, I think they called it county attorney, maybe district attorney, something like that, won his election, won some other posts in the state, and eventually ran for the United States Senate, and he won, and he ran again, and he won, and he ran again, and he won. For years and years, Alvin Barkley was a senator in this state. In fact, the end of the story is he never lost an election. He was a popular figure in this state. So much so that he could have run for about anything, and if the people of Kentucky had gotten to do all the voting, he would have been elected. And he was just one of those people, an orator. Never used notes when he spoke, and sometimes an hour at a time would literally hold audiences spellbound, and just talking about the issues of the day. I well remember where I was the 30th of April, 1956. As a barely a teenage boy. My dad and I were standing in a little automotive shop down in the western tip of the state, and somebody came in and breathlessly, excitedly said that Alvin W. Barkley had died. Now, the end of his story goes like this. 1945, Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly, 12th of April. Harry Truman had only been vice president a few weeks, and he was suddenly thrust into the office. And in that Roosevelt term, he served most of it. Truman served out most of it. And when he came up for re-election in the election of 1948, he had managed to get himself so unpopular that nobody, including Truman himself, thought that he could be reelected. But he turned to Alvin Barkley, and he said, I want you to run with me and be the vice president. And Barkley said, like a lot of intelligent people have said, I have no interest in being vice president. But Truman said to him, he said, if you don't run with me, you're going to be responsible for the demise of our party and for the ruin of our country. Now, with that kind of pressure, Barkley acquiesced to the wishes of the president, and he ran with him. And lo and behold, election time rolled around, and everybody, the pollsters, everybody, nobody thought that Truman and Barkley could be elected. In fact, so much so, the Chicago paper, the day after the election, in bold headlines said, Dewey wins. But Dewey did not win. Truman and Barkley won that election, and they served that four-year term together. And in the spring of 1953, they left office. Barkley came back home to Kentucky, and he began immediately traipsing up and down the length and breadth of this state, getting himself ready to run for the United States Senate and get his Senate seat back in 1954. Well, guess what? As always, he won. And he had only been in the Senate about a year and a half that last go-round on that fateful day in April when the news came that he had died. I stood on the streets along with my dad a few days later, and literally tens of thousands of people flocked down to Paducah, and the streets were lined for miles. I mean, 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 people deep to see the funeral entourage. Ike was there, Truman was there, other dignitaries from around the world were there. And that event unfolded without me knowing the circumstances of his death. What I learned later, in fact, much later, was that the day Barkley died, he was at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, had just made a speech in a convocation there, and he had, in that speech as he was winding down, he did, as I am told, he did many hundreds of times in his career. He quoted his favorite verse from the Bible, Psalm 84:10. And it turned out that on that day in April, it would actually become the last words that would ever fall from his lips, because after quoting it, he froze momentarily in his tracks, fell over backward on the platform, and was either dead when he hit the floor or within seconds thereafter. So this text, Psalm 84:10, became his last words. A day in thy courts is better than 1,000. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. Now, I've thought about that, and I've said, if somebody like Alvin Barkley, who rose to a pinnacle of power, if he got hold of this and said, it's important for me to serve God, it's important for me to put priority on whatever post that I have with God, and it's a bigger deal for me to serve God than it is for me to have some high position in the world's economy, then I said, if that be true for a man of position and a man of prominence and power, a man who was popular just in almost an unprecedented fashion, I said, if it be important for him, how much more should it be that somebody like me and somebody like you, that we also claim the promise, claim the priority, and just say, whatever the world offers, whatever is in the offing by the various things that come in my life, I will nonetheless set my priority to say, whatever God says, that's where I will go. Whatever God orders, that is what I will do. And I will place my priority there. Now, when you work through this chapter, it's an interesting setting in which this verse is lodged. The top of the chapter says that wherever God dwells, it is an amiable place, meaning it is a pleasant place. Wherever you find God in residence, you're going to find that the place has an aura about it. It has an aroma about it. It absolutely is just something when God is in audience and when he occupies a particular place. And so God being in, this being the tabernacle of God, it is pleasant and amiable and delightful. And so much so that the psalmist said, my soul longs for the place where God dwells. My soul longs for the courts of my God. He said, I want to be in that dwelling place where that God has taken up residence. Now, whenever you read this verse number 2 that talks about the courts of the Lord, it conjures in my mind some of the places that I have visited in the world where that there was a great, great house. I'm thinking about places like the Hearst Castle in California, or the Biltmore down in North Carolina, or just a couple of weeks ago, I was at the Greenbrier in West Virginia. That is, I didn't even know the thing was there for years. Absolutely unbelievable, the kind of edifice that it is. The White House and the new Schwanstein Castle in Germany. I mean, some of you have been to at least one or more, or maybe all of those places. And when you see those great, great palatial places, Kensington Palace in London and places like that, oftentimes what you'll find is they'll park you out a little ways, maybe 100 yards or so. They'll park you out, and then you'll walk along little sidewalks or little corridors about like this aisle. And sometimes as you're walking along those aisles, there'll be little narrow canals alongside, a little narrow, shallow canal. Sometimes there'll be little fish, multicolored fish and frogs and other such things that they've placed in there, and other adornments and enhancements, statues and pieces of sculpture and other such things alongside. And as you walk up that little narrow pathway toward the big house, often it will be so majestic, I mean huge columns, and it will just be breathtaking as you approach it, and you'll step up to these huge doors, and the doors will be opened, and you'll step inside, and inside maybe there will be a huge atrium, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 floors in height, and it with all kinds of things, and you'll look in every direction, and you're just so impressed as you step inside of it, and you'll walk along an inner court walkway. And oftentimes in those huge places, they will have an inner court that will be maybe as large or larger than this room. I've seen them that would be maybe an acre or an acre and a half of land. That is an inner court that is open all the way to the sky. And they will have around that little fountains and pools and other kinds of enhancements. And yet it is open to the sky, which enables, verse 3, the sparrows and the swallows to come in from their flight and swoop down into that inner court of the great house. And as they come in, they find little places up in the eaves or behind some of the fixtures. And there they make trip after trip, bringing little pieces of mud and stick and grass and rocks. And they laboriously deal with all of that and mold it into a nest. And there in that nest, after a little while, they begin one at a time to put the eggs. And after the eggs are laid in the nest, there's a period of incubation where they sit on that nest and keep it warm. And finally, those little ones are born. And they will then again make other trips bringing little bits of food, worms and other such things to feed those little ones. And a day will come when they'll begin to nudge them to get out of the nest and to get them started in their own ability to fly. And this verse number 3 says that the sparrow hath found a house, and it's in the big house. She has found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young, even thine altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. And so what happens? Those little birds have the sense, the God-given sense, the innate sense. They have the intelligence, the know to come into that place. And there in that great house where God dwells, those little birds make their nest and rear their young. And there in that place, they set for us an example. Surely if we have any understanding that is understanding, if we have any scope of intelligence about how we ought to conduct business as a family, it would be that we too would be sure that our little ones are reared in the altars of God, and that we occupy the place that God occupies, and that we too find the sweet, pleasant place that God has determined residence. Now, you'll notice that there are 3 beatitudes, 3 of them, in this passage, the blessed word. It says, first of all, that they who dwell in the house of God are blessed. I'm just telling you, you take up occupancy where God lives, and there's going to be all kinds of benefits that accrue from living in that place. That verse number 6 says then that the man who takes his strength from God is a blessed man. I'm telling you, you run with God and there'll just be some things that will accrue to you and you won't even hardly know that it's coming. And you'll say one day, my soul, I had no idea the strength. I had no idea what was happening to me. But just being around, hanging around in God's house has in fact strengthened me. I'm telling you, you run with the wrong crowd and like parasites, they will sap the strength out of you. And you need to understand, you cannot run with a worldly crowd without it having a negative impact upon you. You cannot make close companions of a worldly, devilish crowd without it sapping you of whatever strength that you have. But the opposite is true when you run with the right crowd. You hang around with God and His people, and you will find that strength is building up in you. The third one of those Beatitudes is found in verse number 12, where He says, the man who trusts in Thee is a blessed man. Now you say, what is this business of trust? The business of trust is we find what God says in this book, and we say, that's the way it is. We read in the book that God created the heavens and the earth. And when some evolutionist comes down the pike trying to get us to sign on to his wishy-washy agenda, we simply say, no, thank you, sir, because God has already spoken about how it came about. And I'm not interested in some Johnny-come-lately's evaluation and assessment of it. And that's simply trusting that what God has said is the way that it is. And so we see these blessed Beatitudes. And you say, well, I don't know. I think I can make it. I want you to notice verse number 6 talks about passing through the valley of Baca. That Baca valley is the valley of tears and sorrows. And you say, well, I've not been there yet. Well, you live a while and you will be there. There will be a time when you will hurt with such an ache that you think your heart will break. There may be a time come when your eyes will be so flooded with tears that it will be as though that verse says, passing through the valley of sorrows and tears, that valley of Baca, it will be as though that the tears will fill up a well. No need for the rain. You will flush your own eyes and you thus will fill the well. I'm telling you, you're going to need God's strength when you have that day. You're going to need to be in companionship with God when you have that day. And so this is the setting of it in which He says, knowing all of this to be true, He says, consequently, therefore, I had rather have a day in the courts of my God, in the great house, in that inner court where the swallows and the sparrows are. I had rather have a day in occupancy there than to have 1,000 in some other house. I had rather, he said, be a simple doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tent of wickedness. Now, let me talk to you a little bit about what he means by that, about being a doorkeeper in God's house. You know, it's awfully easy for us to assume that, well, God's just somewhat fortunate to have us. And it's awfully easy to come to a place where that we walk into Shawnee Baptist Church and we say, Pastor Mattingly, I want to do something in the ministry. You've got some place for a director. You've got some place for an executive superintendent. You've got some place for a vice presidential post. You've got some place for me. I'm just going to be the big shot in this place. And you've got some place like that. That's just me. That's what fits me. And, I suppose all of us at one time or another have gotten a little bigger than we actually are and thought maybe that we ought to fit into some role like that. That's not what this passage is about. This passage is saying, just give me a simple spot. Just give me some little post in God's house and I'll be happy there because it's better than anything that the world has to offer. Now it takes, if you're going to be a doorkeeper in God's realm, it takes a humble, servant-like spirit. But after all, I think about the great man Moses. I mean, you read the Old Testament. And my soul, Moses, is a man of great stature and revered among the people of Israel even to this day. And yet, when God spoke of him, God said, Moses, my servant. You think about when the Apostle Paul put his signature on some of those epistles, how he identified himself. He said, Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ. You think about the Lord Jesus himself. He said on one occasion, I am among you as he that serveth. And so it is that that spirit of a servant is what needs to catch hold with us. So that, I mean, if God promotes you and if God gives you some place of prominence and some place of power, God bless you for it. But be willing to serve. Be willing to reach for the low post. Be willing to take whatever God gives and serve him. And just thinking about the doorkeeper, the simple assignment in the house of God. It's such a necessary duty. I was privileged to pastor in Westminster, Maryland for a long time. And the first year that we were there, I'd been there maybe 9 or 10 months. And one day I looked up at my office door and there stood a man that I knew, I recognized. He and his wife were in the church when I got there. And I could tell when I saw him by his countenance, I could tell that he was upset. I stood up and I said, Howard, come in. What's going on? And he walked over to my desk and he looked at me and his eyes were just jumping. And he said, Pastor, he said, I have been going to church off and on all my life. And he said, I have never heard somebody talk like you do every Sunday about people getting saved and born again. And he said, I've come to the conclusion after these months of listening very carefully to what you say every Sunday. He said, I've come to the conclusion that I don't have it and that I've never had it. And that I'm not saved. You know, I was so delighted that day to be able to tell Howard that God was just happened to run a special on it that day. And we stood there and never did sit down. I opened up a New Testament and led Howard Otto to Christ, standing there at my desk. And he turned around and walked out of that place. I had no idea the impact of that time that was going to have on him and upon me. I had no idea. But it wasn't but a little bit until Howard was following me around on Sunday, and he was attending to every little detail. Now, very early in our time there, I started an 8:30 service on Sunday morning. An 8:30 service. We had to. We didn't have enough room. We had to. And back here, almost 30 years later, they're still doing it. And I started that 8:30 service, and now up there, now you have a little winter here, but you don't have winter like winters can be had, compared to some other places. And, up there, we did have winter starting about Thanksgiving and sometimes continuing all the way to April and, off and on, not harsh like Buffalo, but at least second cousins to Buffalo. I mean, we have winter up there. And so I would, in preparation for getting my voice warmed up for that 8:30 service in the wintertime, I would stop at a place coming in on Sunday morning. I would get a cup of coffee. Now, you gotta understand, I don't like coffee. I don't even believe in coffee. I ain't preaching against coffee sometimes. I just don't like it. My mother never would let me drink it when I was growing up, and I just don't care for coffee. But I discovered that it would warm the vocal cords in that cold weather. And so I would come in with a big tall cup from a fast food place, and Howard learned that I didn't drink the coffee, I only sipped it. And so I'd have about that much out of it. And I'm telling you, he would meet me at 8 a.m., and as I walked in the door, he'd know that I was already warmed and ready, and so he would take that cup from me. At a little after 9:45, after I had hosted a class in the main auditorium and turned it over to somebody to teach, I would go back to my office. Now, when you preach at 8:30, you're going to preach again at 10:45. Let me tell you what you do during Sunday school. Some mornings you take a nap. Some mornings you eat lunch. Some days you order up other special things, and you take full advantage of that time so that you can preach with full energy and vigor both times. Howard learned that. And so he would have that coffee rewarmed for me when I got out of the Sunday school class. And then he would say to me, now, Pastor, what would you like to have? Now, I learned if I said, I think I want a sandwich, he would go bolting out of there, me fishing in my pocket, to give him a $10 bill, and he would go bolting out of there and go get whatever I hinted that I wanted. I learned I had to be careful about saying what I wanted, because he would go get it and have it back in short order. And he would do that, and when he would get all that in place, then he would say to me, week after week after week, he would say to me, now, Pastor, I will be out in the hall, and if you need anything, want anything, you need an errand run, you need anything, just call me, I will do it. Now, remember, I didn't ask for any of that, it just developed. Early on in that, he and his wife got a set of master keys for the entire campus. We had several major buildings. They arrived then, and still do, at 6 a.m. every Sunday morning. They go over that campus with a fine-tooth comb. They open everything that needs to be opened. They are sure that everything's locked that needs to be locked. If there's something that is overflown, if there is something that is out of sync or out of whack, they deal with it. And I'm telling you, not one time in all those years did they ever come rushing into my office to say, "Oh, Pastor, you can't believe what's going on in restroom number 13. You can't believe what kind of a problem we've got in that restroom." Never once. They carried in their pockets phone numbers of who to call. I'd sometimes not even learn about stuff like that till Monday. Because they were seeing to it and taking care of it. Now, you say, what in the world was their problem? And what is their problem that has gone on all those years? Listen, Howard has never one time, not once has he ever led in prayer on the platform. Not once has he ever been on the platform for somebody to salute him. Not once. He's one of those people, sits in the background. And I'm telling you, half the people that go there to this day don't even know what he does. And you say, what is the deal with a guy like Howard? He found a doorpost. He said, "I want to serve, and I will be the doorkeeper in God's house." And I'm telling you, that kind of a servant performs an absolutely necessary duty. By the way, you notice in this text, it's a preferred assignment. He said, I had rather be that than to have something that the world thinks is great stuff. It's an absolutely blessed thing. And you say, well, I guess probably you just pick up a guy like that. You know, just anybody? No. The doorkeeper is somebody who has proven himself in some way. He is a trusted worker. We had, for a while, a friend who worked on the Secret Service staff at the White House. And every once in a while, he would take us in down there at some odd and unusual hours. And one night, we were down there on a Friday night, about 10:30 at night, after everybody had gone home. We were walking around through the corridors of the White House, and we walked along that outer court that leads toward the Oval Office where the Rose Garden is, went in the outer office, and as soon as we stepped in, I saw the open doors to the Oval Office, and on either side of it, there were two United States Marines in full dress uniform. And I said to our friend, I said, "Whoa, what is this?" He said, "Those doors are never left unguarded. There is somebody at those doors of that office 24/7. And I'm looking at that and I'm saying, I bet I know where they get those guys. Those guys that do that, they're the guys that they wimps. They won't go to war. Those are the guys. They probably never done anything. They're probably just raw recruits that just showed up last week. And they said, I will put those guys in charge at the White House." Don't you think for a moment. No, sir. I didn't check, but I can tell you. Those guys are guys with a track record. Those are guys that got some other assignment they handled well. Those are guys that they let do something else, and they proved themselves, and they got in the ranks, and they did what they were supposed to do. And now then they're getting to do something that only a few people ever get to do. And that's our duty at the White House. I'm just simply saying, if you want to serve God in some capacity, if you want to serve God in some capacity, take care of whatever little assignment that is handed to you. Just take care of it. Handle it. Stay with it. Do a good job at it. Do a better job than anybody's ever done. I was thinking about this text in June a year ago. Betty and I still go back to Maryland a lot. Dr. Belcher has been pastor there now almost 12 years, my former church, and our dear friends, close friends. And we can come and go there pretty much at leisure, and he's not the least discomforted by that. And one of the ladies there that's also a public official, in fact, a rather prominent politician in Maryland, a dear friend of ours, and she was a member of the church there, still is, and we go up to her house just pretty often. Betty goes often, and I go with her, and we sometimes just take vacations and go there and have her house when we want it. And June a year ago, we called her up, and we said, "Nancy, we're coming up last week of June." Now, I knew Betty and Nancy would get out, and they'd be into all kinds of things that they like to do, but I was going to really have a spiritual vacation, and I had gotten tickets to go see the Orioles play four nights. And I was going to go Monday night, Tuesday night, Thursday night, and Friday night. I booked the Sunday nearby to preach all day on Sunday on both ends of the week. And anyway, we called Nancy up and we said, "Nancy, we're coming up." And told her the time, and she looked at her calendar. She said, "Oh my," she said, "my kids and my grandkids and I are going to be gone on a Caribbean cruise." She said, "We're not going to get back." Ben and I were going to get in on a Friday. She said, "We won't get back until Thursday." But she said, "No problem. You all come on like always. Use the house." We said, "Okie dokie. We can handle that." So sure enough, we went up on Friday. I went and made my preaching assignment on Sunday. And I was going to go to the ball game on Monday night. But it rained. Oh, it rained cats and dogs and parakeets and, I mean, just all kinds of things. It rained torrential downpours. And I didn't go Monday night. I didn't go Tuesday night. I didn't go Thursday. I didn't go to the ball games at all. I was a mess. Oh, I was just, I mean, I was just fit to be. Well, anyway, the week changed on us. Tuesday afternoon, Nancy called. She and her kids had gotten back off the cruise, got off the boat mining. She called us, chatted a couple minutes, and then she said, guys, she said, I've got a bit of a problem. And she said, I know you're all on vacation. And she said, I don't even want to ask you and bet it. I both said, Nancy, just tell us, what is it? And she said, I had a voicemail on my phone when I got off the boat. And she said, now this was Tuesday. And she said, Thursday afternoon. And she said, I'm not getting back till about 3, but at 5 o'clock on Thursday, the governor of Maryland and a little entourage of Maryland political VIPs are coming to the house. And she said, I'm going to need food, and I'm going to need this, and I'm going to need that. And I said, and Betty said about the same time, no problem, Nancy, it's raining all the time. We can't go do what we want to do. No problem. So the next 2 days, I mean, we enlisted spick and span and all of their relatives. And I mean, we put the polish on that house. I mean, it was spotless. Betty went out and went shopping and we got food. I went and ordered a cake almost, well, it was as big as the top of this pulpit and put on it. We love our gov and had all of that ready to go. Nancy got home Thursday about 3. She come rushing into the house. Betty had all the food arranged and laid out. Nancy came in. She said, oh, she said, now what can I do? What do I need to do? And I said, wait a minute. I said, you just get ready for your party to come. And I said, Betty has this kitchen all arranged and everything's ready on the food. And I said, Nancy, I'm going to go in and I'm going to get one of my preaching suits on and I am going to be the doorkeeper for this event. She looked at me just stunned and she said, Pastor, you're not going to be the doorkeeper. I'm not going to let you be the doorkeeper for this. And I said, Nancy, it's a job that needs to be done, and I can do it. I'm telling you, I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. She relented. I got myself dressed, and I posted myself with the door. In a little bit, the folks started coming one by one. Turned out I knew a lot of them, and they were a little stunned to find me at the door, and I was having to explain, we're house guests. We're helping Nancy. I'm the doorkeeper. We got all that in place. I went to the door. Guy standing out there. I said, come right in, sir. Guy stepped inside. He said, where's the governor? Where's the governor? Where's the governor? I said, oh, he'll be along in a little bit, sir. He'll be along a little bit. He said, I want to see the governor. I want to see the governor. I've got something to talk to him about. I had something going on here. And so I eased over next to one of the governor's aides, and they'd already sent the state police in to sweep the house for bombs and bugs and bums and stuff. And the aide was standing there, and I said, sir, I said, do you know this guy? He said, no, I thought you knew him. I said, no, I don't know him. And I said, I think we got a problem. I said, I think he's here to embarrass the governor and to create a problem. It was not an announced public event, but somehow the guy had found out about it. And so I tell you what, I learned something about this doorkeeping business. I learned that the doorkeeper gets to decide who comes in, and he gets to decide who goes out. And with the help of a couple of people who were somewhat bigger than me, we disinvited the guy who had not been invited at all. You said, my soul, you're a preacher. Absolutely. And I know how to call a spade, and a skunk, a skunk. I know where right is and where wrong is. And when wrong is wrong, the preacher ought to say so. And so we just muscled up on that guy and invited him to the street. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I said, why are you who man the door? You sometimes think it's just a matter of turning the knob and opening the door. You don't realize if you don't cover that post, something may go wrong. If you don't cover that post, something may not happen that ought to happen. If you don't cover that, what in the world will we do? Brother Mattingly, I look around this room tonight, and there's a brother over here who's been manning the sound booth all day long, and he and whoever else mans that sound, I thank God for them. I don't do nearly as well if he's not on duty. Little voice difficulty today, and my brother, if you hadn't have been on duty and if you had not helped me out, I would not have done nearly as well today. I look around here a little bit ago, and I saw ushers, in fact, all day long. There have been men, businessmen, professional men, men of various occupations, working these aisles, up and down these aisles all day long today. I'm going to tell you, I've tried, and I know probably you have as well, I've tried having church without those guys a few times, and it's not near as much fun. I'm telling you guys, you just did it because you thought you were assigned to do it, and you don't think sometimes about how important that it is. I was in a meeting recently in North Alabama, and every once in a while I'd draw some detractors, and I just got up and started to preach, and there was a guy sitting right back over there, stood up and started yelling at me and calling me names and trying to shout me down. And I'm telling you, some of the doorkeepers in that good church, several of them packing heat. One of them in uniform, a local policeman, was sitting about 15 feet from that guy. And they got to him. I never missed a beat. I just kept walking and stirring and preaching. And they carried him out the door. He was mad about something. I'd run in the store and come for a ways just to yell at me and to create a scene. And some of the doorkeepers in that good church, some of the men, were ready, and I mean instantaneously when that began to happen. They just surrounded that guy and swooped him and his little entourage right out of there and took care of it. And I'm just simply saying, I mean, you think about the bus routes that you run here, and there's some folks probably that nobody has any idea. Well, now, of course, now in Kentucky, it's probably different. In Kentucky, probably all of the buses check their own oil, right? Probably change their own oil. Well, I mean, the expensive buses, I mean, they probably change their own oil. No? Oh, you mean somebody has to pull the dipstick. Somebody has to check it. Somebody has to do the change. Somebody has to gas the bus. Oh, who is that somebody? It's a Howard Otto. It's a somebody guarding the door to the Oval Office. It's somebody. Maybe nobody knows anything about, but they're helping to man the ship, God's great place. Whether singing in the choir, or playing in the orchestra, or ushering, or working back in the nursery, or manning these children's ministries, or some other such thing. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, rather be in some post that maybe nobody else wants, than to have some position somewhere that everybody thinks is important, but may not be important at all. I was down in Atlanta, October last fall, at Dr. McCoy's church. Preached for him on a Sunday morning and a Sunday night. And as we were making our way from his office to the auditorium for the morning service, I saw something in his church that I have never seen anywhere, except in an airport. I stopped when I saw it, and I said to Brother McCoy, I said, "And what is this?" And he explained to me, it was a double shoeshine stand, very similar to the ones they have in the airports, only the nicest one I have ever seen. Somebody in the church grew it, made it, donated it to the church. Brother McCoy took a bunch of the young men from the church over to the Atlanta airport, and they hired one of those shoeshine men at the airport to teach those young men how to do professional shoeshine. And now then, when you go there on Sunday morning and Sunday night, there are some of those young men, 16, 17, 18, 19 years of age. They have their aprons on. And they are manning those shoeshine stands, and you can walk in there, get up there, and get your shoes shined. And the deal is, they cannot take money, no tips, no nothing, because Brother McCoy said, this is a service to our people and to whoever visits here, and the folks that are manning that are learning how to be doorkeepers, I think. We walked on along that corridor. I said, Brother McCoy, unless I miss my guess, you've got some future missionaries training right there at that shoeshine stand. And probably some young men who will get the heart to be a servant at that shoeshine stand who will wind up pastoring a church down the way. I suspect that it will be so. And you say, well, that doesn't seem like much of an important post in God's work. Well, it's just one of those doorkeeper things. What I'm saying to you tonight, and I want to say to you all over this room tonight, if I were to walk around, as I might do sometime, and if I were to say to some of you men, now what is it that you do here? And by the way, I'm not fussing at you now. I'm coaching you. But if I were to walk around this room tonight, and if I were just to say, oh, dear brother, what do you do around Shawnee Baptist Church? Some of you would say to me, oh, you would say, well, now, you know, I'm just a layman here. I just sing in the choir, or I'm just an usher. And I'm going to say to you now, dear brother, please don't say it that way. Because being an usher, being a choir member, being a bus worker, being a soul winner is not a just a situation. It is not. If I were to walk around to some of you ladies tonight, and hey, I'm not fussing at you, I'm just coaching you, all right? But if I were to walk around and say to some of you ladies, what do you do here? What do you do here? Some of you would say, oh, I just sing in the choir, or I just work in the nursery, or I just help with some of the children's groups. Now hang on, please, don't do it that way. Don't say I'm just a nursery worker, because it's a whole lot bigger deal than that. Just like preaching without that sound man and preaching without those ushers, I've tried preaching a few times without nursery workers, and I'm telling you, it is not near as much fun as when you ladies and men are on duty back here in Noah's Ark Nursery. Not near as much fun. And I just want you to know, this business, I mean, wherever you have placed your hand in this work, and in this ministry, you need to understand, it's a pretty big deal. I had the privilege for a long time to pastor what I thought, Brother Mattingly, thought then and thought now. Love them then, love them now. I thought was one of the grandest churches in the whole world. But not one time, not even once in all those years, could I have stood up and said honestly, I have all the help that I need. Never could. And I know that that would be true at Shawnee. Because as the family grows, as the church progresses, the needs just accelerate and multiply. And I'm looking around tonight. I know that many of you are doing single duty, double duty, maybe triple duty. But there may be several people in this room tonight who just have an idea that there's just no need. There's just no way that you can be. I'm telling you, I don't care if you're 105. I promise you, if you want to be a doorkeeper, you see Brother Mattingly, you see Brother Snyder, you see Brother Delaney, you see Brother Todd, you see some of these folks, and you tell them, if there's some one of these doors that needs somebody to manage, and we're not just talking about physical doors now, you understand? If there's a place where I can be a doorkeeper in God's house, I'm willing to serve. And I promise you, they'll find you some kind of a place to serve. You think with me about this. For a day in thy courts, a day in thy courts, like the little swallows and the sparrows who found the place in the altars of God to rear their young, a day in thy courts is better than a thousand elsewhere. And I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tent. I'm pretty special.